down here in front of the people at the National. We don't get many wild animals in Italy.
What kind of animal was it?
Raccoon. Like this big rat.
For example,
so last time we finished giving a look at this little toy model for understanding some of the conceptual issues of general relativity, because if you remember, we discussed what the setting was like, and we realized that if you want to try to take seriously this coincidence of space-time with the gravitational field, then we have to face both conceptual and technical difficulties. And in order to deal with the conceptual ones, we introduced this system in which we had two pendulums, but we didn't have a watch in order to measure the oscillations with respect to time, and so we decided to, instead of doing dynamics the usual way, namely A, B, the two oscillations, and T, and dynamics is a rule that tells us A of T and B of T. We decided that if we are short of watches, we can actually do dynamics in a different way, which is using A and B. And the dynamics is then given by not a real Hamiltonian, but something that is called a super Hamiltonian, or the Hamiltonian constraint, which is a relation between these two variables. And then what we can do is to describe the dynamics of one watch, of one pendulum in terms of what the oscillations of one pendulum in terms of the others. And then we said also that this idea can be pushed forward to the at the quantum level. And we said that in a similar way to what we do at the classical level, we might start with a wave function on some extended Hilbert space, big H, so that it makes confusion with the Hamiltonian. It's always very important to choose the notation in a confusing way, so please learn. And then this will be some L2 on R2 with the usual metric. And then the idea is that the Schrödinger equation becomes, so we would write down the Schrödinger equation in the following way, but because at the classical level, now the Hamiltonian is actually a constraint, a function that is constrained to vanish, we try to interpret and give a meaning to this right-hand side of this Schrödinger equation. And as I was saying, this is called the Dirac's procedure because it was described and proposed for the first time by Dirac. And the idea is to interpret this equation as a restriction on the admissible states in this Hilbert space here. So we said that if a state satisfies h of psi equals 0, then we say that psi is physical, namely belongs to a subspace of this extended Hilbert space, which we call the physical Hilbert space. And your exercise is to actually try to do this for the case of this timeless double oscillator. And the idea is that this Hilbert space here, which is a subspace of the general Hilbert space and is the subspace that contains all the physical states, namely all the states that satisfy this constraint here, can be obtained through a projection from the bigger Hilbert space. So this will be the last question in your exercise. And to describe what I mean by this, think about the fact that in ordinary quantum mechanics, a useful operator to deal with the dynamics is typically the exponential of the Hamiltonian constraint. Sorry, of the real Hamiltonian. Okay? So this is a typical useful operator in quantum mechanics. In our context, we are going to use a similar operator, but it's going to be, oh, thank you. Good. So we are going to use a projector operator in order to implement this idea of going from the bigger Hilbert space to the smaller one. which, if you want, you know how you can, you know about the delta, Dirac's delta, right? Everybody knows about this function. It's not a function, it's a distribution, but everybody knows about this. And probably everybody knows that this can have an integral representation where it can be written in this way. Is everybody familiar with this notation? Perfect. So here the idea is that, you see, the projector has to be something that makes sure that the Hamiltonian is zero. So formally, something like a delta of the Hamiltonian. I put commas, these things here, because it's not really a well-defined mathematical object, but just to give you an idea. A better defined mathematical object could be that we integrate e to the I, the Hamiltonian that is now the Hamiltonian constraint there, from minus infinity to plus infinity in general, in order to give an analogous expression to this one that is implementing a delta. Okay? So in the exercise, you will have actually to build up a precise representation of this operator and see explicitly how it does the job that you want. So anyway, the lesson from this exercise is that the conceptual problem of not having time, of having an Hamiltonian that is not an energy but is a constraint that has to be zero, can be understood by this diagram here. Namely, what the general relativistic dynamics tells us is that out of the starting variables which we have in our problem, some of them should be truly interpreted as time. And then the dynamics is how the others would evolve with respect to this time. Okay? So this is a conceptual approach to understanding the problem of time. Now, if there are questions with this, please, because then I would like to move forward to the technical problem of how to deal with it in practical terms, because in the case of the double harmonic oscillators, you should be able to on your own, but in the case of generativity, which is a nonlinear interacting field theory, is much more complicated. So what's going to happen in there is that what are the physical, you remember that we said how we described the meaning of diffeomorphism invariance, and we described how the true physical objects of the theory are not metrics intended as specific functions of a point, but more classes of equivalents of these functions here under the orbits, or more loosely speaking, under the action of transformation of coordinates. There's no physics in having a particular choice of coordinate with respect to another choice of coordinate. The physics has to be independent from this choice. This is the ansatz we are working on. So, of course, from the conceptual point of view, what that example tells us is that I told you how this is, you can think of this as a symmetric 4x4 matrix, which means it has 10 components. The 4 on the diagonal and then the 6 off the diagonal. Out of these 10 components, somehow you can think of these as various, let's say, harmonic oscillators. One of them, the Hamiltonian, is going to pick up one of them as the time and make the others evolve with respect to this one picked up. This is the rough idea, okay? In fact, we have already written down last time that the Hamiltonian constraint was something that depended on our particular phase space choice. Remember that we did that decomposition, defoliation, that helped us identifying what the canonically conjugated variable were. And this equal to zero should be thought of as this equation here. In fact, here I didn't write it, but in the exercise sheet, you will see it explicitly. This is, of course, just like a normal Hamiltonian, a function also of the conjugate momenta, okay? So that it doesn't confuse you, the fact that in here there's also, I think I'd call it just P, the conjugate momentum to G. So in order to understand what the technical difficulties of trying to implement these ideas are, let me just restate that the canonical structure we are looking at had this form, which I hope I had convinced you that is reasonable. CdB, for instance, I had told you how, because these are symmetrized, in principle, I can choose A to be equal to C, but also A to be equal to D. And because I'm running out of space, I'm going to introduce a shorthand notation. With these round brackets, I mean delta of A, delta of B means delta of A, delta of B plus delta of B, delta of A. So it's a symmetrization. And then I told you how here, because in principle we are in two space, different space points, here we're going to have this three dimensional now, the product of three Dirac deltas. Okay, that was the canonical structure we were working on. And the action, which typically would be something like PQ dot minus the Hamiltonian, becomes something where I have minus becomes, you remember, JAB, PAB, and then these new variables N and A, which were just the off diagonal part on top of the metric tensor. So here I have G00, here I have this off diagonal part G0A, here I have the GAB block, and then I had renamed for commodity, I had renamed this NA and this one minus N squared, because you remember we had the choice of signs. And to be more precise in the definition, there's also the scalar product, but for our purposes, it's not that important. What is important is that the action principle, sorry, the action is going to look like this, where here we have G dot AB, PAB, and then minus N, some function of G and P, and minus NA, some other three functions of G and P. And now when you take the variation of this action with respect to, in particular, N and NA, you see that this is linear in N and NA. So you will get, among the equations of motions, you will get four equations of this type. There are four because this is one and these are three. A can go from one to three. So these are the equivalent of this one equation here that we have for the timeless double pendulum. So these are the things that are going to tell us how some components are truly dynamically depending on others in a similar fashion, at least at a conceptual level. Because now trying to make sense of this is going to become immediately complicated, because let me try to follow the same steps that I have in there. So I have that structure. So I have, for brevity, GMP equals some delta. And then I have H of GMP equals 0. And I have HA of GMP equals 0. And we say that in order to study the quantization, first of all, we put hats onto things. So we are going to try to transform these into some hatted guys with some IH bar now, and then the same delta in there, precisely as if you have more than one, if you are, let's say, in 3D, you're going to have a canonical structure like this. And so when you do the canonical quantum theory, you're going to have IH bar and then the same delta. So there will be the same delta there with the commutators. And then this thing now, these things here would become operators acting on some psi that this should be equal to 0 and some other three operators acting on the same psi. So now we have more than one restriction. Just like in here, we have more than one conditions that these variables have to satisfy. Also, the wave function will have to satisfy more than one condition. There should be more projectors. One after the other, I should implement all these three projectors, right, in order to get down to the physical state. So you might imagine that psi belongs to some initial Hilbert space, and then I can project it down with, as we said earlier, some delta of these three guys here, for instance, and I get some intermediate Hilbert space. Let me call it HD for reasons that will become clear later. And then I could imagine to implement also the last one and get down finally to the real physical Hilbert space. So try to apply the same procedure, this time in more steps because I have more constraints. However, the problem is here at this level. Oh, yes, please. Oh, HD. I had to give him a different name, right? It could, oh, yeah, they're all H's. That's why this confusing notation is good. They're always H's. If you don't know what I put, put an H. So the problem is already at this level, because here we knew where to start, right? Some Lebesgue space of integrable functions over R2. Here, what are we going to put? What is the space? And notice how, for instance, this measure here is invariant under translations, so it implements a useful symmetry that is present in our classical system, namely the symmetry under translation. Here, I'm going to need some kind of Lebesgue concept of measure on a space of metrics which are supposed to be identified up to these diffeomorphisms. Well, this is rather more complicated than what we had in here. And the truth is that it's so complicated that, in fact, there's no a nice mathematical answer to this problem. So this is, for this kind of presentation, emerges as a key technical problem. The one has to try to understand and solve if he wants to try to implement this idea here. So the lecture is on loop quantum gravity. The lectures are on loop quantum gravity. So up to here, I've just been doing, as I told you from the beginning, trying to build up from scratch a quantum theory of gravity in which one blindly applies the normal concepts of quantum mechanics to general relativity and its peculiarities. Now, the first novel concept that leads to the approach so-called loop quantum gravity is going to enter. And it is exactly aimed at solving this problem, or at least improving the situation. And this is a step that was taken in the 80s when an Indian professor, Ashtekar, that is now in Penn State, realized that you can make a change of variable in the theory such that you know how to deal with the initial Hilbert space to then work your constraints out. So a change of variable, I'm assuming that you are to some extent familiar with, even in an action principle. No? So perfect. So that's the idea. And in fact, the interesting thing is that what he realized is that you can reformulate a GR in such a way that its basic variables, instead of being the metric, where I remind you that the metric is what tells you how two things are far apart. So infinitesimally, the infinitesimal distance between two space-time points is given by the metric tensor. So this is the physical interpretation of the metric tensor. And what it realizes is that you can reformulate the generativity. Instead of using the metric tensor, you can use variables which are very similar to the variables that you use for electromagnetism. So this is the key step that in today's class I'm going to try to convey to you. And we already know, actually, the first ingredient for these change of variables, because you remember how from the very beginning I told you that you can think of, if you think in Einstein's terms, in the equivalence principle terms, what the gravitational field really is what tells you how you can locally put yourself in an inertial frame. So what it really is a set of four vectors which tell you locally at each point of space-time tell you how to go from arbitrary coordinate, non-inertial, to Cartesian coordinates, and this point by point, you remember. And the relation between these And the metric tensor, we saw that it's easy to derive because think that you're using now Cartesian coordinates. Well, we define it like this, sorry, mu dx. And now imagine that you were using Cartesian coordinates, then this interval would be written exactly like you do in a special relativity. So you would be writing these as, and remember, we use the indices I to recall ourselves that these are Cartesian coordinates, such as in special relativity. So I would be writing it like this. And if I now imagine that locally, these psi are functions of some non-inertial coordinates x mu, so this would be, the differential transforms according to the gradient. So this is just dx psi I over dx mu, dx mu. You remember our convention, every time an index appears twice, that means I'm summing over it. So what I've written is just the usual dx psi is equal to the dx psi of x is equal to grad psi times the vector of the x's, right? That's what I've written here with this Einstein summation rule. And this other guy here, dx nu, which tells us that we can identify g mu nu with eta j, and then these two objects here, which are often called the tetrad field. Why tetrad? Why tetrad? Because you see that these are four I, both I and mu. They run from 0 to 3. And so for each space-time point, we have four vectors. So tetrad means something with four legs, these four vectors. That's why it's called the tetrad. And this is the equation I have in mind, and the equation that if I were smart, I would have written on the top left. So I'm going to write it again here on the top left, even on a different board.
Sorry, we just were still on that board for writing.
Ah, yes. Okay, so g mu nu, the metric tensor, we can write it as eta j, e mu I, e mu j. And we also saw that it is convenient to call the g00 component n squared, where I put a minus to remind myself that I'm using the convention where if I just look at space, then the metric is positive definite. And so the pseudo component of the metric, typical also of special relativity, will be explicit in the time component. And this 3 by 1 piece, I can call it any. Okay, we have already introduced this notation. So one thing that should be clear at this point is that the symmetries that we are looking for in our theory and that Einstein's field equations implement are the symmetries under changing coordinates. So I can always, if I start with a non-inertial coordinate system, I can always make transformations, go to a new coordinate system, and after 3 years of painful reflection over this, Einstein finally decided that yes, this should be the case, the theory should be completely invariant under this change. Which means that you can see that these are, yes, so maybe this is a not such a nice notation. I should have said x mu goes into some x, well, it was okay as a notation, I suppose. Okay, x mu goes into epsilon mu, which is truly a function of the initial x's, okay? You can see that these are four functions, no? Because there's one for each dimension. And these components of the metric tensor this diagonal one G00 and this off diagonal one G0A, there are also four components, which I can call G0 mu, okay? Just to put them together as four. So it shouldn't be surprising if I tell you that I can, and you can, and of course it should be rather clear that if I make a change of coordinate, the explicit form of the metric tensor is going to change. You remember how we drew that blob that we say this is the space of functions? If we now make a change of coordinates, this is going to change, of course, the explicit expression of this function. The key point and the change of coordinate is going to move me from one point in this space to another point. But the key idea is that the physics described by these two different metrics is the same as long as they are related by a change of coordinates, okay? So if I make a change of coordinate, I can arbitrarily make this metric uglier. I mean, an example that you might be familiar with if you're doing a triple integral in space, you would be integrating over the cube x, right? So where x are the Cartesian coordinates. However, sometimes it is convenient to change coordinates and to use, instead of Cartesian coordinates, spherical coordinates, for instance. You might have seen this example. Well, in Cartesian coordinates, the distance between two points is expressed is just dx1 squared plus dx2 squared plus, maybe a smarter notation would be this one, which you can think of as being eta ij dxi dxij, where instead of eta I should have put delta, because this is simply a diagonal unit matrix. Where is the other zero? If I make a change of coordinates and I go to spherical coordinates, then I can imagine that, well, now the distances will be expressed in a different ways, because now I'm looking at a description which is going to be dr squared plus r squared. And then if I'm purely in spherical coordinates, I'm going to have one azimuthal and one zenithal angle. So it's going to be something like d phi squared plus sine squared phi the theta square. So the metric tensor, if I want to write it in this form again, has become 1 r squared sine phi squared. Still 0, so it's still diagonal. But it's now a function, very explicit function of the coordinates, whereas in here it was just a constant. And you can imagine that you can pick up horrendous coordinates such that you give also non-diagonal terms to this metric tensor. I'm using now more loosely the word tensor, hoping that it gets in your vocabulary. So if I make a change of coordinates, I can change the shape of the metric tensor. So to make life a little bit easier, it is very conventional to assume that whatever is the shape of your metric tensor, and the change of coordinates I can make are four, right? Because there's four coordinates that I'm changing. So I have freedom, I have, let's say, 4 degrees of freedom. So in principle, I can choose these in such a way that four of these components pick up the explicit expression I want, okay? I can play this freedom, I can play this game for four different times. And it is customary to actually, regardless of the starting point, always choose coordinates in such a way that this part here is particularly easy, by which I mean it has the 4 minus 1 and then all zeros. And I don't touch, this one is going to become uglier, whatever. I don't care. What I care is to put this part here into this simple form. Is it clear? Or, I mean, we can easily do it explicit in the sense that you know that, let's say, I told you in the first class that if I make a change of coordinates, e mu of x prime is given by dx prime, dx nu over dx prime mu times e mu I of the all the coordinates, seen as this is a bit sophisticated, but anyway, which means that g mu nu is going to transform as of x prime, is going to transform as dx rho over the x prime mu, dx sigma over the x prime nu times, so this is a new, so it's the physically is the same gravitational field, but it's expressed in new coordinates, such as this one. And these Jacobians of the change of coordinate tell me how this guy transforms. So I can always say, let's say I can always choose x prime. So let's say, for instance, g00 prime will be given by dx rho over the x prime 0, dx sigma over the x prime 0 times, times rho sigma. And I can impose as a condition on my change of coordinates x prime equal x prime of x, the fact that I want this to be precisely minus 1. So this is a condition that I'm imposing, and I can, and of course it selects the change of coordinates, okay? So I hope that this is clear, that if I change the coordinates, I can, explicit expression of the metric changes, and that I can play around this freedom in order to fix the way I want four components. And that this is the customary choice. In this customary choice, this expression here now, you see that simplifies as well the expression of the metric in terms of the tetrad. And it becomes, so that expression, I could already write it explicitly as the metric, this is just diagonal, right? It's just minus 1 and then 1, and all the rest is zeros. So what that expression really means is minus e mu 0, e mu 0, plus e mu, okay, yes, e mu I e nu j, delta I j, for instance. I can write it like this. This is just the diagonal metric, okay? However, what happens if I make this choice of coordinate, which it is often called, so a choice of coordinate in generativity, it's also called a choice of gauge. And this is often called the proper time gauge. So if I do this, you can see that this decomposition here, it's equivalent to this one. So the guys with the zero here are just trivial. So e mu zero is just 1, 0, 0, 0. And the guys with an I have a zero first component with respect to mu. So they are of the type 0, and then the generic vector that will enter in here. I'm using A for a three vector, so it would be EAI, okay? So this equation, well, this equation I should read it like this, but then I can read the information on just this 3 by 3 part to be GAB equal EIA, EJB, and then delta IJ. So basically, I've done something extremely simple. I have taken that initial expression, and I've projected everything down just to the three-dimensional subspace. So that now I'm only playing with indices. I goes from 1 to 3, as opposed to big I, that was 0, 3. And A also goes from 1 to 3, as opposed to mu, that used to go from 0 to 3. Okay? These are still indices that transform according to the Lorentz symmetry, as we described at the beginning. These ones transform only under the spatial part of the Lorentz symmetry, so the rotations, spatial rotations, because you know that the boosts would involve things which have also a time dependence, right? These are space-time indices, and these are just spatial indices. Now, I'm going to define an object that and give it a significant name. First of all, notice that EAI is a 3x3 matrix. So it will have entries like this. And it's a 3x3 matrix at each point of spacetime. And of course, being a 3x3 matrix, I can define the determinant of this 3x3 matrix, which I'm going to call E. So E is the determinant of EAI. This, of course, is a function of space like this. And in principle, you can even, you know, I don't know if you know this expression, you know the Laplace expression for the determinant of a matrix? There's a nice way of writing it, which is, are you already familiar with the completely anti-symmetric object? That you might have seen this when you describe the mixed product H between three vectors. When you take the wedge, when you take the vector product between two vectors and then the scalar product. Is this how you, no, maybe like a cross? Cross, perfect. So you know when you, if these you can write it explicitly in components as epsilon ijk ai bj ck. Just as the scalar product between A and B, you can write it as ai bj delta ij. So maybe you are familiar with, and you can use these to express the determinant. It's actually true, it works, you can work it out, and you will get, it's the Laplace expression that it will look like 1/3 factorial to get rid of some redundancies. And then you're gonna need two of these guys, A, B, C, and then, oh, the other way around. It's nice to keep track of what's up and what's down and to always make sure that when you have a double index, one is up and one is down. Whoever of you is taking also general relativity might appreciate to be careful with that. And the KC. And truly, there's nothing mysterious in this expression. You know that to compute the determinant with the Laplace method, first of all, you typically don't use it for 3x3 matrices, in which case I think that you typically go with the diagonals, right? Maybe. But if you have 4x4, you know that you have this rule that you have to put a chessboard and put plus and minuses where the white or black boxes would be. And those plus or minuses are encoded in the fact that epsilon 1, 2, 3 is defined as being 1, whereas epsilon 1, 3, 2 is minus 1. When I flip 2, which you can think of as having flipped, having passed from the first column to the second column, you know that you have to change the sign. So basically, what this epsilon is doing for you is to implement that chessboard, the thing that you have to do when you compute the determinant of a 4x4 matrices, which is a way in which you can also compute the 3x3 determinant. Like, you can say you do this one times the determinant of this matrix, minus this one times the determinant of the matrix built by these two. Okay, you can use the same method for a 3x3 one. And so this is a nice algebraic expression for the determinant, which you are going to need also in the following. So yes, I had promised you to define something with a nice name. And I'm going to start again from here. Can I erase here? Can I erase here? Yes. Any questions so far? So I'm trying just to show you how we can now reformulate general relativity so that its variables look like electromagnetism. So the first step was to make this choice of coordinates so that the metric would simplify. The second step was to realize that we can deal only with the space part of the tetrad. This was just an algebraic definition of the determinant. And now I'm gonna, and now I'm gonna define, let me, I'm gonna take, first of all, I'm gonna take the tetrad, the tetrad has four legs. This guy here has been unfortunately maimed, so he has lost one, because I goes only from 1 to 3, so this is called a triad, because it only has three, okay? Just remember that we are in 3D now, mutilation process. So I'm gonna take the triad, but This is technical, but again, for who's taking generativity, let me write it precisely. I'm going to take the inverse triad. So the inverse of this matrix here, okay, where A is up and I is down, I mean the inverse of this matrix. So I'm going to take the inverse of the matrix and multiply it by the determinant as I've defined it, okay? It is a nice exercise, which I should have put in the exercises, but I didn't, to use this formula here to show that this is actually equal to epsilon ijk, epsilon abc, ebj, eck. And there might be a numerical factor there, 1/2. I never get it right, so I'm not even going to try to write it down. But it's a simple exercise starting from there. So you might want to do that to get some practice with this kind of notation. And now this friend here, I'm going to give it a nice name that maybe can remind you of something. No? The electric field, maybe? Maybe not. What notation do you use for the electric field in America? Because I never know. Here you call things in funny way, like the degrees, you call them Fahrenheit. The meters, you call them yards. This funny thing, so. The pride, very good. So anyway, so I've given it now. So I've given it this name precisely because I'm going to show you that this is some kind of electric field in some sense. So at least it has some similar properties. What happens, what Ashtigar and then other people working on these ideas realized, is that you can make, you know what a canonical transformation is? Or sometimes it's called a contact transformation. It is when, in classical mechanics, you start with a system QP, and then you define a change of coordinates in phase space to new variables, let's say Q prime and P prime, which are functions of the old ones, so they can arbitrarily mix up variables and conjugate momentum, such that the Poisson structure does not change. Okay? So typically, these are the only transformations you're allowed to do in Hamiltonian mechanics, okay? So you want to make sure that the Poisson structure, well, this is what I call the Poisson structure. I don't know if you put it like this, but anyway, you want to make sure that the Lagrange transform is still well-defined and so on, okay? So a canonical transformation is something that allows you to change your variables and still be able to do Hamiltonian mechanics in the usual way without encountering problems. So what happens is that Ashtigar realized that you can make a canonical transformation and go from GAB, which is a canonically conjugate momentum that satisfied, as we said, delta AB CD and then a delta cube in space, because these two functions are defined in general in different points of space. You can make a canonical transformation. So that should not change the physics, and show that in this canonical transformation you get precisely this friend here as one of the canonical variables, sorry, as your configuration variables. So this will be evaluated at some point, and it has a canonically conjugated variable. And this canonically conjugated variable, because you already know where I'm going, I'm going to call it big A, you know, like the vector potential in electromagnetism. So this will now have, as well, an index of type Latin from the beginning, by which we mean 3D space, and an index Latin from I, by which we mean an index in the rotation algebra. Remember, it was the Lorentz algebra at the beginning, then we did this gauge fixing procedure here. We chose this coordinate so that we were left only with the possibility of rotating our local Cartesian coordinate frame, okay? So it has become an index that tells you basically if instead of being Cartesian in one particular reference frame, you rotate your reference frame, you're still inertial, okay? So that what's gonna be changed is this index I here. And this one will also have an index, and it will define in general a different point. And the, as I promised, the Poisson structure is preserved. So this is a delta AB, delta IJ, and delta cube of X minus Y. And notice that this time there's no need to symmetrize because these indices live in different spaces. Okay, in order to give you the full, oh, of course, this is a canonical transformation. So just like in here, these variables are defined starting from the original variables. So this will be a function of GAB and its conjugate momentum. And this will also be a function of GAB and its physical momentum, which I don't tell you explicitly because these are rather complicated transformation, but take my word for it. And to give you the complete Poisson structure, you know that even in here, you typically, you never do, but you typically should also say that this Poisson commute or their Poisson bracket is zero. And here as well, same story. E has a Poisson bracket with itself of zero, and A has a Poisson bracket with itself, and it's always zero. Also, this one is always zero. Eh? It's not zero just when you are, when the indices are the same and you are in the same point. Okay? So, okay, now what turns out is that the conjugate variable to E behaves like another object that had been known in physics since a long time, which is the connection of a gauge field, and in particular, the connection of a non-abelian gauge field. These are the fundamental objects that are used to describe the nuclear forces, such as the electromagnetic weak force, sorry, such as the weak nuclear force and the strong nuclear force, okay, the ones that keep the neutrons together, the protons together, they keep the quarks together, and the ones that are responsible for the beta decay, for instance. You might have heard of names such as the Z boson or gluons. These objects, which are the carriers of these forces, are described precisely by fields that look like this, namely connections on non-abelian gauge fields. Non-abelian physically means gauge fields that can interact. Z boson, W bosons, gluons can interact with each other. Electromagnetism is a simplified version from a mathematical point of view of the same structure in which the connection is a connection of an abelian gauge field. Abelian means physically that this does not interact. And in fact, photons do not interact with each other. They do interact with matter, but they do not interact with each other. Okay, so when we speak about something abelian, we mean something physically that has no interaction with itself, non-abelian it will have. And now I'm gonna give you a little bit more details about what these theories are like because we are gonna need it for the proceeding of our general relativity understanding. So we begin by the simple case of electromagnetism where this connection is abelian. And first of all, why am I calling it a connection? So you probably are familiar, well, you know, you've taken electromagnetism, so you know that you can take any sort of variables to describe electromagnetism. You probably have started saying, oh, electromagnetism is when I have E, when I have E and when I have B. I have an electric field and I have a magnetic field. And then maybe somebody told you, hey, but look, these two guys, you can put them together and build up the stress energy tensor, which is an anti-symmetric matrix with A and B of diagonal. And you probably have seen a formulation of the, have you seen the Maxwell's equations, for instance, in which the Maxwell's equations are just written as partial differential equations for this object here. And you, maybe you have seen also a description in which you take as fundamental object a mu, the vector, the four-vector potential, which is typically, you can think of this as, so this is a four-vector, it has a zero component and a spatial component, and you can think of these in not this such a direct way, unfortunately, but a little bit more indirect. If you have this guy, you know that E, the electric field is given by, I think there's a minus, the time derivative of, okay, let me just say that it's spatial for the moment. The time derivative, so this is just a three vector. The electric field is just the time derivative, and the B field is the rotor. Do you see rotor? You call this the rotor? No, the curl, thank you. Yes, the curl of A, okay? So you know that in principle, A, it's a fundamental object because it allows you to reconstruct E and B, the physical manifestations of the electromagnetic field. The problem with A is that it is not a physical manifestation of the electromagnetic field in the sense that you cannot measure it because this is called the vector potential, and just like any potential is, let's say, defined up to a constant, for instance. You know that you can never, when you introduce the concept of potential in your theories, you never assume that you can measure that. You're always interested just in the differences of potential, right? A similar story applies in here. So that's why when you think in physical terms, you think in terms of these two quantities, which are observable, measurable. But nevertheless, it is a significant, I think, aspect of our understanding of the world that our understanding works so much better in terms of this quantity here that in principle is not observable. And when I say our understanding, I mean the fact that if you're just describing the Maxwell equations in a classical sense, then this description is fine. If you want to describe the quantum interaction of a relativistic electromagnetic field, it turns out that doing it in this notation is extremely ugly and complicated, whereas this notation is extremely more powerful. So this is some kind of fundamental question, whether there is this tension between something that is physically non-observable, but more communicative to our mathematical approach, and something that is observable, but to some extent less communicative. I think that we have been taking a course in foundation, right? And I think this is also a kind of question that one could add to that kind of course. So there are two characteristics of A that are of interest for us now. One is, what is the meaning, the physical meaning of A? We said it is not an observable, but what is the physical meaning? What is the intuition behind it? Like E tells you how a charged particle accelerates, B tells you how a moving charged particle bends, okay? So what is the physical meaning of A? Well, the physical meaning of A is that it tells you if you have a charged particle in a point X and you move it along embedded in some electromagnetic field, which you're going to describe by A, and you move it along to some other point Y, then the effect of these, of the electromagnetic field on this particle is somehow encoded in the line integral of A. So you know what a line integral is? Perfect. So let's say that this, I call this gamma. So gamma is the parameterization. So I have some S that goes from 0 to 1, such that gamma of 0 is equal to X and gamma of 1 is equal to Y. And then I can parameterize this trajectory as gamma A of S, where A goes from 1 to 3. And the line integral of a three vector is AA contracted with the derivative of the parameterization of the curve, which is just the tangent, right? So at each point, you take the part of A which is parallel to the tangent, and then you integrate over. This is integrated in dS. So, and this is, so I'm gonna call this quantity, which depends on A the vector potential and the chosen path, I'm going to call it, let's say, A of gamma. Okay, let me use this notation. So this is called, this is the line integral of A, and the line integral of A is a number, because I'm integrating some particular value of the electromagnetic field. So being a number, I can take the exponential of a number. Oh, actually, yes, let me use this notation here that I think is more intuitive. This, by this notation, I mean this line integral. I can take this exponential of a number, and roughly speaking, if I have a charged particle, this in field theory is described by what is called a scalar field. The scalar means that at each point is just a number. So I have a quantity which in every book is going to be called phi, so I won't be different from that. And it's a scalar because at each value, at each point of space, it gives you a number. Okay, for instance, if you're not familiar with this, you can think of the temperature. Temperature is a scalar field. Wherever you put your thermometer, you're going to get a number. You put it here, you get a number. You put it here, you get another number. So you describe that with a scalar field. And so morally what happens is that the value of the scalar field, which has some properties such that I can use it to describe a charged particle, is going to be changed by this line integral, okay? So this is, roughly speaking, what is the physical meaning behind choosing the vector potential as opposed to E or B. It knows how a charged body feels the electromagnetic field. This is the one property that we know, that we need. So property number one. Property number two has to do precisely with the fact that this is not an observable. What does it mean that it's not an observable? Is that, oh, look at the superiority of this eraser. There. It means that in particular, the equations of motion, I take that back, by the way, means in particular that the equations of motions do not determine its evolution. So there is no prediction for the value of the vector potential. Okay, in this sense, whereas this is not what happens typically. When you do classical mechanics, the whole point of doing classical mechanics is that you can predict the evolution of Q and P in time, right? You cannot do so for the vector potential A. Why? Because it has to do with the fact that you can always rescale by an arbitrary constant the potential. And in particular, in your electromagnetic course, you have seen that the vector potential, the equations, the Maxwell equations are invariant if I change the vector potential by what is called a gauge transformation, in which I pick up any completely arbitrary scalar field alpha of x, I take its gradient, sorry, this notation, I take its gradient and I rescale, so its gradient, I mean, d over dxa of alpha of x. So if I rescale the scalar potential, sorry, the vector potential by the gradient of a scalar, the physics does not change. For instance, you probably have seen the simple exercise that B, defined as the curl of A, is the same if you make this rescaling of A. You probably have seen this in your electromagnetic class. What does this mean, and why is it as a consequence that is not predictable? Because the fields equation, the Maxwell equation, do not change under this rescaling. So I can imagine, if I want to study the evolution of A, to start with some initial value, and then it's going to evolve like this. But then I can imagine that at some point in time, I actually rescaled it like this. I introduced at some point some scalar function and did this rescaling. Because the equations of motions are invariant, that's also a solution. But it's rescaled, so it's different. So the evolution of this new guy at the point where I've done the rescaling is going to look like something like this. Okay? I think you've seen this argument in your class. So the second point that we need is that it's a non-observable or non-predicted, because it depends on the gauge. And that property here is the property that connects the properties of a charged particle at a point x with the property of a charged particle at a point y. And because of this reason, it's called a connection for electromagnetism. You know it as vector potential. I like to call it the electromagnetic connection. Same thing. Okay, now all of these, because I wanted to show you how you can now try to implement this idea here. You remember? Of reduction, of projecting down to the physical space. Let me get to that point in the next 5 minutes. Because remember that now we are trying to understand how we can technically deal with the problem of imposing these constraints at the quantum level. We have already done a first step, which was done by Ashtekar, to show that the canonical variables can be recasted in a way that look like the ones of electromagnetism. And concerning these, I still haven't finished the story, because you see that the vector potential of the electromagnetism, it's A with a space index, but it has no index up there. So I haven't finished the story yet. But this is going to be a generalization of the vector potential and the electric field of a very specific type that I'm going to tell you about later on. So these solved technically our problem that was already solved, because it disappeared there, solves this problem, because now if I start with variables which are A and E for the electromagnetic field, somebody clever has already solved this problem in that case. And so this is why I'm doing it. I'm going to come back to this point, of course. But just to tell you what the logic is, that now with this change of variables, we can deal with this problem here. But then the other thing is that this is going to give us an example, electromagnetism, of how to also deal with the projection. Okay? And the example is the following. So, as I've just anticipated, when we now, okay, yes. So keep in mind that this property here, keep in mind this property, that the physics should not depend on this rescaling. When you do this gauge transformation, the electric field is the same, the magnetic field is the same, Maxwell's equations are invariant. So this is pretty much like changing coordinates in general relativity. In fact, that's why it's called the changing gauge. Because it's just that you take your voltmeter that you're using and you change the gauge in it. So the physics is the same. It's just like you're rescaling the units you're using. So there's no physics in this change. And this is what we are going to implement. And so, as I said, first of all, if you're not trying to do the quantum theory of the electromagnetic field, which you haven't seen yet, but I'm going to anticipate it, and please notice that I'm going to anticipate the quantum theory of the electromagnetic field in a way which is not the way you're going to look at it when you take quantum electromagnetism. When you take quantum electromagnetism, you're going to see the quantum theory of the electromagnetic field in terms of photons, because that's the one that has the more direct physical interpretation. So you're going to see how a photon is quantized, how a photon interacts with matter, not with itself. I'm going to give you a different presentation of the quantization of the magnetic field that, if you want, you can think of it as, imagine when you quantize the harmonic oscillator, you know that a good basis for the harmonic oscillator is the basis of eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, right? The energy eigenstates. However, nothing prevents you from choosing the X basis, right? A basis in which the operator X is diagonal, just like you would do for a free particle. It's just a change of basis. In fact, you know very well how you change basis from one to the other. This bracket notation tells you the coefficients of a change of basis. And this is just the Hermite polynomial. Notice how very importantly it's a big H, once again, consistent notation, everything has to be a big H, times the Gaussian like that, that depends in an opportune way for the omega of the harmonic oscillator. But you remember these things, right? You can change a basis in your Hilbert space always with a unitary transformation. Okay, more or less. So the representation of the electromagnetic field in terms of photons, which you're going to see in your classes, it's called the Fock space representation, and is not the one I'm going to tell you about today, but the two are related by a change of basis, okay? So don't go to electromagnetic class and go and say, oh, that guy at PI told us just crap then, because this is what it really is, okay? It's just a change of basis. So in this basis I'm choosing, I'm going to look just as in here, I was looking for wave functions of Q on which I usually have the Schrödinger representation that Q multiplies and P gives me the derivative. And if I choose this, there is a well-defined Hilbert space, which is just, let me call it some Hilbert space on the space of connections with some measure, okay? It's a different space than R2, and the measure, it's a different measure than the Lebesgue measure for R2 that you know. But nevertheless, these are now mathematically sound objects, and they're well-defined, and we can do calculations with them. In particular, you know that the reason why you need a measure in quantum mechanics is that you want to be able to define the scalar product and make sure that the scalar product is positive definite so that the particle, so that the probabilistic interpretation holds. So that's why I always stress that there is a measure in here, and we can deal with that. However, now if I take, and this of course is a vector, eh? So it's like if I'm doing the harmonic oscillator in three dimensions, psi is going to depend on x, y, and z on a vector, right? So here as well, it's going to depend on a vector. This vector is also a function of space, so the situation is more complicated. In fact, it's a quantum field theory. It's not just a quantum theory. But those kind of complications will not affect us very much, so maybe not at all. So what happens is that in order to be physical, to describe physics, classically, every physical quantity would be invariant if I rescale A by A plus this gauge transformation, because that's just changing gauge, okay? So classically, those are the same things. So if I have a classical observable O of A, plus is going to be equal to O of A plus the gradient of alpha. Example B, the magnetic field, okay? Or the stress energy tensor, okay? So at the quantum mechanical level, I want something similar. If now I consider psi of a configuration of the magnet of the vector potential A, and then I consider A rescaled by this gauge transformation, by this symbol, it's a shorthand notation, eh? I mean the gradient, really. In the extended initial Hilbert space, they might even be different, but I know that I want the physics to be independent of this choice. So in my physical Hilbert space, these two things should be the same, okay, precisely as a classical observable is independent on this gauge transformation. Also, if now psi, let me call it psi p, belongs to the physical Hilbert space, then this invariant property should be satisfied. And you might already be suspicious that whenever there's a projection from a larger Hilbert space to some physical Hilbert space, maybe there is some kind of constraint equation behind it. But let's put that aside for the moment. Let's discuss that later. And for the moment, let's stick to the fact that we want to implement this on our physical states. Because implementing this is extremely easy. Because think of this as a finite dimensional example, not field theory. But think of this as it was just a requirement for a function on a plane, let's say. So a function of two variables. So I have a function f of x, y, for which I'm going to shorten the notation and just call it f of x a, where a is equal to 1 and 2. And now I want this function to be invariant under translations in a certain direction. Let's call it lambda a, OK? Which basically means that truly, even though I had x1 and x2, which in fact is probably nicer, instead of x1 and x2, what I'm really interested in, there's some vector lambda. And I'm really just interested in the one-dimensional subspace orthogonal to it, because translation in that direction, I'm not interested in those. How do you implement that? Saying that the function should not depend on translation in certain that direction. So for instance, saying that the gradient of this function along the direction lambda, so the directional derivative should be zero. Okay? It's like, maybe I can do it even simpler. If I want f of x, a function of one variable, to be the same under translations, what does that mean? That the function is constant, right? The function is invariant under any rescaling for any a, okay? So it's truly not a function, okay? It's just a constant. So what does that mean? Is that the derivative of this function is equal to zero, okay? Sorry, yes, maybe I didn't specify the point. For arbitrary a, if I require it for a particular a, then no, it's different. But if I require it, I should have specified, if I require it for any, this to be true for any a, then the function has to be the constant, so the derivative has to be zero. In two dimensions now, I could require the same thing in one particular direction. For instance, I could require f of x1, x2 to be equal to f of x1 plus a, x2 for any a. And that means that this function does not depend on x1. It only depends on the second variable. Namely, it means that df over dx1 is equal to zero, okay? So in the general case, that's what I'm going to have. I don't want the function to depend on a particular direction. I take the directional derivative and impose it to zero. Is this clear, this example? Because now I'm going to do exactly the same thing here. I don't want the function to depend on one particular direction, the direction given by this vector. Forget the fact that the vector itself is now a gradient. Eh? That doesn't matter. This defines a vector. So I want that there, I had this. So this now lambda is my direction vector that I don't want dependence on. So it's dA alpha. So I have that dA alpha of x times the derivative of the function with respect to its components, right? This is d over dx a. So in here, I should put d psi physical of a over d a a, okay? And impose this to be equal to zero. The analogy is clear, right, so far, I hope. Because now there's a technical step to be taken, which has to do with the fact that these are not numbers, right? These are functions themselves. So the derivative has to be dealt with a little bit of care. Yes, no problems with time. So a little bit of care, which is to some extent not so surprising, because you already know how to generalize from a real derivative to a partial derivative, right? So you know that if you start with a function of one variable, then you define its derivative as df over dx. If you now have a function of n variables, xi, then you define the partial derivative, df over dxi, okay? And now let's make a nice step. Here, this I is a discrete index, right? It takes only integer, well, in fact, natural values, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. However, let's imagine that what happens if this I becomes a continuous index. So here, I belongs to the natural numbers. But now suppose I have some phi, sorry, some f of, let me use a slightly different notation. Here, you agree that I could have called this a, okay? And here I could have defined the derivatives like this. Okay, so no problems with this, perfect. So imagine that now I becomes a continuous label. So it belongs to the real numbers. So instead of I with a pedex, sorry, instead of a with a pedex I, I better write a as a function of I, okay? Because now this is, a has now become a real function because I is in the real numbers. And when your variable is in the real numbers, instead of calling it I, it's typically nicer to call it x. So let's make this drastic change and call it a of x. But nevertheless, let's try to close our eyes and define the derivative precisely as we did before. Here, we say the derivative with respect to a of I. And notice that in order to remind us that this is a partial derivative, we change the symbol, right? From d to curly d. So let's once again do the same thing, and let's once again change it so that we remind it something yet different. So I'm going to call it delta. And here I can try to put precisely the same thing, okay? And here this is a function of a. So the result of this derivative depends on I, okay? If you change I, you're going to take the partial derivative in a different direction, you're going to get a different result. Correct, no? You agree with this? Perfect, yes. Ah, no. Thank you. Fantastic. Thank you. No, thank you. So this now depends explicitly on the index I, namely depends on the direction in which you're taking the partial derivative, okay? If you consider them all, you can build up a vector, an n-dimensional vector out of this. Here, this is going to depend on the space point, okay? You take the derivative. So if you take it in the origin, the value will be different than if you take it in another point, okay? And you can think of this as an infinite dimensional vector, whereby changing the point arbitrarily, you get a new row element in your vector. But it now has become infinitely dimensional, not only infinitely dimensional, because if you think that I can go all the way from one to infinity, this was already an infinite dimensional vector. Now it has become a densely infinite, okay? So there is this sort of step to take, but once you've taken this step, then the definition just goes smoothly. In order to mathematically be sound, though, there is a problem that we need to deal with, and is the fact that this function here, it's itself a function defined in a point of space. So there's a coordinate in here as well. So let me call it y, because it's in general different from this one. Okay? So I have to tell you how to deal with this difference here, which is going to take a second, because it's going to simply use a concept that we already used, namely the Dirac's delta. Okay? So this derivative, Let's do an explicit example. For instance, my function of a of x is a of x squared. Okay? So the functional derivative of f of a of x with respect to a in an arbitrary point, just like this one, it's f of a of I, but then I take it with respect to some direction j, right? I don't have to take it in the same direction. So here I could have any point x. This is going to be just like a normal derivative to a of x. And then I have a Dirac delta that tells me that the two points have to be in the same place. The two points have to coincide. Let's see if I can try to find a point to wrap up. Okay, so that defines for you the functional derivative. And what we are interested in is in this particular, so this is now a functional derivative. With respect to some point x, the same point. And now what we want is that to impose that this condition is equal to zero. Now, I don't know. There was another technical point that I had in mind, but I think I can. Yes, actually, I don't need it. Perfect. So, in the last 5 minutes, so if you want, you can think of this as the constraint that we are imposing. Okay? So you see, I've defined this functional derivative. So this is what imposes me. If psi satisfies this differential equation, then it's invariant under this rescaling, precisely as in here. If this is true, then this is invariant under these translations. And if that happens, we call psi a physical state. So it lives in the physical hyperspace. Okay? So far it's just definition. This functional differential equation, let me write it as dA of alpha of x times the functional derivative over A of x acting on the physical state. Okay? This has to be equal to zero. Okay? I've simply, just like in here, just a notation. But with this notation, now I can extract this object here. And this object here is an operator precisely as in the, our original example. Once we go to the quantum mechanical system, this is going to become an operator made out of A, B, minus I, the derivative with respect to A, minus I, the derivative with respect to B, which are the operatorial representations of the conjugate momenta. And this operator acts on functions of A and B, and you want to find the function such that it gives you zero. This is a particularly simple even. You should not even complain, because it only depends linearly on some kind of derivative, okay? So I'm not going to call it H for once. I'm going to spare you. So H is gone. Let's use G, the one right before. So I'm going to call this G with a nice head because it's an operator. And so the operator constraint that we are looking at here is this G of psi equal to zero. So even in electromagnetism, even though it is a much simpler theory than general relativity, there's no conceptual problems. It's linear. It's non-interacting. Much simpler. Nevertheless, even there, if we choose to quantize it this way, in this basis, not in the Fock state basis, also there, we have to deal with the concept of constraints. And this shows us technically how to do it. these constraints act on these states. What it means is that the physical states are independent under these changes, and this reflects at the quantum level the classical invariants. Okay? Are you dead and tired? Perfect. Okay, then I'll stop here, and next week we'll finish this part in which I will show you what is the physical meaning of this constraint, which is something that you should know very well, because what this constraint is the Gauss law. This is the implementation at the quantum level of the Gauss law of the classical electromagnetic theory, okay? So we're gonna finish this part, and then we're gonna generalize this concept of gauge connections to the non-abelian case, which is what we need to deal with quantum general relativity.